You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I'd just like to welcome all of you here. This is actually an event that is hosted by our program on global economy and development. And I'm Fiona Hill, the director of the Center on the U.S. and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program, but we always collaborate very closely here at Brookings. And this is a great event that we've been looking forward to for some time. Because it features one of our very closest colleagues, Johannes Lynn, who many of you will know from his various guises at the World Bank and also when he was the director of the Wolfensohn Center here at Brookings. He's still a fellow at the Program on Global Economy and Development. But Johannes is also now leading an effort at something called the Emerging Markets Forum, which we'll see featured here. And has been focusing, as he has for many, many years, on economic development in the broader Caspian region and specifically in Central Asia, and how economic development, trade patterns, communications, transportation, everything have been reviving since the collapse of the Soviet Union several decades ago now. It's really quite remarkable to think how long this is. But, of course, Johannes still looks remarkably youthful, as do the rest of his fellow panelists, in spite of looking at this for a long time. And today, we're celebrating the publication of a book that has come out of one of the conferences that they held in Switzerland on the developments in the broader region. And the book is available, or was available, it still is at the front of the meeting. And two of the main authors of the book, and who were also participating in the forum in Switzerland, Martha Olcott, our colleague from Next Door at Carnegie, and Pradeep Mitra, who was the chief economist at the World Bank and specializing in Central Asia, are both here to talk about many of the issues that were raised in their chapters in the book. And we're especially pleased that Martha is here. You might have seen Johannes and I huddling at the beginning because we were trying to figure out which Central Asian country she might be in if she wasn't here. Martha is just finishing off two books that we'll plug now because I'm sure we'll all be hearing about them soon. One on Islam and the state in Uzbekistan, which is just finished and about to come out. And another on Tajikistan, and she's just come back from Tajikistan. This afternoon she's going to testify in Kyrgyzstan down at the Helsinki Commission at the Congress, and then she's heading off to Kazakhstan, and we also have the ambassador of Kazakhstan here. So we ought to have a chart here plotting Martha's moves around Central Asia as part of this, but in any case, we're really pleased that she's here. And Pradeep Mitra, we're also very pleased. He just came from a little closer, but this is a really good event. And what we're going to do is there's going to be lots of PowerPoints because, of course, these guys all have the World Bank imprimatur on this. At Foreign Policy, we don't bother with PowerPoints. But in Global Development, you have to have a PowerPoint. So what we're going to do is you're going to see us all shuttling backwards and forwards between the podium. I'm going to hand over to Johannes. Then Martha will come up and give her presentation, then Pradeep, and then we'll all cluster over here and engage all of you, because I see there are so many experts on the region here, engage with all of you in a conversation. So thank you very much for joining us. And for those of you who haven't got a seat at the back, there are a number of seats down here towards the front. Please do come down and take a seat. Thank you.
Thank you, Fiona. It's great to be here with under your leadership and moderation. I will all do a good job, I think, as a result of this. Fiona is, of course, a great expert also on Central Asia, and so I'm especially delighted that she's here to help us. And I hope you'll chime in with your own views. Actually, Fiona was the guilty party for why I ended up at Brookings when I left the World Bank 8 years ago, so I owe you special thanks. Anyway, today we, in a sense, celebrate, you said, but it's really just want to make share with you a book that has been recently published by Emerging Markets Forum, or for Emerging Markets Forum by Sage. And as you will have seen, it's in the back. There are also flyers available in case you want to order it. The book is, I have not done a book launch as much as I think, Martha has. So if this isn't exactly what you expected, please accept my apologies. But I figure, you know, we'll try and give you some idea of what the book is about and maybe tease you into actually reading it, maybe even buying it. But we'll see about that. First thing, I want to say a few words about how did the book happen, how did it come about. The Emerging Markets Forum, which is the platform on which, in a way, the book was produced, is an outfit that sits actually right down the street and at the end of Virginia Avenue. The Emerging Markets Forum brings together high-level government officials and corporate leaders from around the world to engage in dialogue on key economic, financial, and social issues facing emerging market countries. And the Emerging Markets Forum organizes events for about 100 to 150 people of this ilk once a year for a global audience, if you wish, and once a year more or less also with a regional focus, in other words, on Africa, on Latin America, on Asia. And we had one set of meetings for the Eurasian Emerging Markets Forum, the Eurasia EMF, in starting 2009 was a preparatory meeting, and then 2010, which looked specifically at the regional integration cooperation issues in Central Asia and the Caucasus, and was strongly financially supported by the Swiss authorities, I should mention here. It brought together experts and representatives from government and corporate sectors internationally, but also from the region itself. And so we had a very good discussion on these set of issues that I mentioned. Fueled, in a sense, this discussion was fueled by six discussion papers, which we've now turned into a book. The six papers briefly listed, I actually map into the chapters of the book. Well, first of all, a chapter, a paper framing the issues, sort of basically setting an overview and asking some questions. If any of you are professors here who need some examination questions for your students, you might want to go and check the questions, because they were then to guide actually not only the papers, the subsequent papers, but also were to guide the discussion at the forum. And I think it's one way to actually motivate our thinking and open up the issues for everyone reading the book, but beyond that, to sort of mull over what might be some of the answers, and perhaps we can follow up on that in the discussion today. We then were very fortunate having two chapters contributed by Martha Olcott, one on the political dimension. One, I was sort of the co-editor, I desperately wanted a political chapter in there, because from my perspective, and you'll see it in a minute again, I'll stress it again, that political and governance dimensions really are absolutely critical as we think about regional integration, cooperation, and long-term growth prospects in Central Asia. So having Martha contribute this chapter from my perspective was an absolute must, and I was very, very happy that she did so. She also contributed a chapter on energy, specifically on oil and gas, which, of course, is a major driver of integration, maybe even cooperation in the region. We had a paper by Richard Pomfret from Australia, who is a real expert on trade and transport issues in Central Asia. He's written about Central Asia for probably 3-4 decades as an excellent economist. Unfortunately, he's not here today because he happens to be in Australia. We had Dennis Detre, a former colleague of mine from the World Bank, who was country director for the Central Asian countries for a number of years, write about the business environment as a key aspect of regional development, regional integration. And finally, Pradeep Mitra, who was at that point still or just retired from the World Bank as chief economist for Europe and Central Asia on the impact of what was then very much alive in 2010 still, and to some extent still today, and we'll hear from him, on the impact of the global crisis on Central Asia. The book, in addition, has a summary of the EMF event, which was produced by one of our Swiss colleagues, Mr. Heim, and it has quite a useful, I think you'll find, a data annex that Natasha Mukherjee produced. Natasha is the young lady who was selling the book back there, but also, by the way, I should mention, was absolutely essential in pulling the book together, working with our publishers, and doing a yeoman job in trying to actually bring the book out. So many thanks to you, especially Natasha. So that's the background on the book. Just to say what the book doesn't do, it doesn't cover the water and energy nexus, the hydro-energy nexus, in any great detail. It does not deal with capital markets and financial integration, or agricultural development and food security, human development, a number of threats that the region faces, whether it's environment, climate change, natural disasters, nor the issues of drugs, epidemics, and conflict. So one has to make choices, of course. These issues are left out. You can find, I'm sure, a treatment of them elsewhere, including, of course, in Martha's work. I just want to mention here that in parallel, there's an exercise going on that is led by the UNDP, referred to as CARAS, Central Asia Regional Risk Assessment, which actually covers a number of the issues, particularly water and energy security, food security, natural disaster risks, and what the international community in particular could and should be doing about those issues. And I have hardly legible some reference. If you want to get the reference to a website, I'd be happy to help you with that. Now, the core of the book and the core of the issue that we're focusing on is the question, how can Central Asia and the Caucasus be effectively connected through the rest of the Eurasian supercontinent and indeed through their big neighbors, since they're landlocked countries, to the rest of the world? That is sort of the big challenge. It's, of course, sometimes seen through the lens of how do you reopen in a way and reestablish the Silk Road, a modern Silk Road, as some people refer to it. So the big issue is really being at the core of the supercontinent, the Eurasian supercontinent. How do we turn what has often been seen as a great disadvantage of landlocked, great distance from world markets into an advantage, namely the fact that Central Asia is now at the center, in fact, of the biggest and the most dynamic economies of the world. Its links, provides a global bridge, a continental bridge to East Asia, to South Asia, to, of course, Russia, to the EU, and to the Middle East, as is sort of demonstrated here. Now, it doesn't mean that all the trade flows will ever flow through Central Asia. In fact, even if the infrastructure and the soft transit and transport aspects work really well, maybe only a fraction of trade will flow physically through Central Asia. But the potential for increased transit and, of course, the other side of the coin, improved connectivity of Central Asia to those big and important and rapidly growing neighbors, at least in the case of East and South Asia, is absolutely amazing. And it's something that I think we've really only begun to focus on and realize in the last 5 years or so. Previously, I think it's fair to say all of us in this room thought of Central Asia as a far away, distant, landlocked, and rather desperate place. The numbers that you see on this slide show the rapid growth in trade between East Asia and the EU, about tripling between 1995 and 2008. Between South Asia and the EU in the bottom right, tripling or more so, and between East Asia and Middle East down on the left, just showing the dynamism of trade that exists and therefore the potential from an admittedly extremely low base that Central Asia has as a transit on the one hand and as an access to market on the other hand. In this sense, therefore, the issue of regional cooperation integration isn't just about creating a larger Central Asian and Caucasus market. It isn't just to connect the countries among each other, but it is really to allow the countries to connect to the rest of the world. And since a lot of that connection has to take place through their neighbors, their immediate neighbors, namely other Central Asian and Caucasus countries, the need for cooperation to establish that link is absolutely critical. Now, some things are already happening. We have, for example, transcontinental transport and trade corridors that are being developed now under the umbrella of a regional organization called CAREC, Central Asia Regional Economic Cooperation Forum, which by now includes 10 countries, including, by the way, China, now Pakistan, and Afghanistan. It does not include at the moment, all the South Caucasus countries. It only includes Afghanistan. Nonetheless, the fact that at the core of this geographic, continental geographic space, we now have, supported by 6 international organizations, including Asian Development Bank, World Bank, EBRD, and others, we now have an effort to develop systematic transport corridors across the Central Asian space is absolutely, I believe, critical. And you can see from the colors, blue is already completed, ongoing is red, green is firm, planned for 11 to 13, and yellow is 14 and beyond. You actually see the potential for the development of not only a physical network of physical connectivity, but also a very important part of it is improvements in trade facilitation and transport facilitation. So this is a set of developments which I think is bodes well for the region, both in terms of intra-regional connectivity, but also connectivity, especially connectivity with the rest of Eurasia and the rest of the world. Now, aside from that, this is the second bullet here. If we wish the physical transport infrastructure and quality of services improvement, we also still have some work to do, the region, I should say, the countries, on trade policy. Tariffs are generally quite low, but joining the WTO is indeed a major challenge and opportunity for these countries, or most of these countries. Some of them, like Kyrgyzstan, are already members of WTO. Making sure the border crossings have efficient and integrated border services, following the example of Southeast Europe, where major improvements have taken place in the last 10, 15 years, is definitely something that is being pursued under the CARIC program, but needs still to be pushed much harder. Behind the border, business conditions are absolutely critical, whether it's logistics that allows the actual trade and transport to happen within countries, but also improvements in the business climate are critical. And finally, monitoring progress. That means making sure that improvements that are being planned and invested in actually happen and result in reduced cost and reduced time requirements for transit and transport and trading. And indeed, one of the strengths, I think, of the CARIC program that I mentioned earlier is that it specifically measures progress in terms of cost reductions and time reductions along the transport corridors that are being supported by the investments that take place under the CARIC umbrella. Now, the bottom line on this part of the argument is that improvements in trade transport are essential, but they won't be easy. We've recently, of course, all of you, many of you have liked to be familiar with some of the difficulties that we have still, whether it's border blockages between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, whether it's export restrictions on agricultural products from Kazakhstan, or other examples where there are clearly still major and significant problems that occur. We still have clear evidence of corruption within countries along transport routes where traffic police extracts payments from travelers. And, of course, on the borders, we still have significant issues. So the challenge now is to actually get over the hump, having made commitments under CARIC and elsewhere. The challenge is to get over the hump and actually get on with it. And this, in the end, I believe, requires the political will and the improvement in the government governance, and especially anti-corruption areas, that tend to be the key to actually promote improved trade facilitation and transport facilitation. And as I will repeat a couple of times, and in a way leading up to then Martha's contribution, it's the politics and the governance, stupid paraphrasing Bill Clinton. Now, a few more words about the business climate, which Dennis de Trey analyzes in his chapter. I will flash up, you won't be able to read it, but just to whet your taste, some data that he pulled together on the business climate. This particular graph shows business climate conditions in Central Asia in relation to some comparator countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, and Vietnam. It shows in the first three columns some rankings of the countries according to the World Bank's Doing Business ranking. The Global Competitiveness Report is the second one, and then the Corruption Perception Index is the third one. We then also have GDP growth rates, net foreign direct flows, foreign direct investment flows, and manufacturing value added. Just some indicators of what the business climate and its impacts in the country, presumptive impacts in these countries, demonstrates. We also have some additional data from his chapter for Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, and for good measure, thrown in Mongolia. Now, if you look at the data, they're not entirely uniform. They tell a mixed stories. There's actually some good news. For example, for Kyrgyzstan and for Georgia, you find that the doing business rankings are remarkably good. If you looked at recently at some of the doing business reports, you'll find that Tajikistan was the best performer in terms of the rate of improvement in the last year or two. However, if you look at some of the other ratings, such as the corruption perception index, you'll see that maybe, as one would expect, the countries for this particular region are basically all in the bottom third or quartile of the performance. Generally, I think it's well recognized that the business climate conditions remain difficult. Now, we all know from, I think, general studies on growth, for example, the Growth Commission under Nobel Prize winner Spence, that the business climate is critical for growth, and it's doubly critical for small and landlocked countries. If small and landlocked countries want access to the big markets, they need to be doubly effective in actually managing their business climate. Central Asia and the Caucasus, I think the data, but also other information shows, is not hopeless. We've had rapid growth in the 2000s up to the 2008, and we'll hear more about this from Pradeep when the crisis hit. Connectivity is improving in transport and, very importantly, internet access. And we have some improvements, some limited improvements in the domestic business climate. Now, each country has its own big challenges in improving the business climate, and Dennis actually looks at each country, and you might want to check that out. However, the point to be made here, if these countries work together or in tandem in improving the business climate, actually there will be maximum benefits because of the spillover effects, the neighborhood effects that we know occur if one country is doing badly in terms of business climate. That actually has bad effects on the immediate neighbors in general also. At the core of improving the business climate will be to reduce the incidence of corruption and, as Dennis points out, to reduce what he calls the credibility deficit for investors. And again, it goes back to it's the politics and the governance stupid in the countries. Now, I will close with a few observations that the Emerging Markets Forum, the Eurasia American Markets Forum, drew out of the discussion, out of the discussion papers and the following discussion, which I just want to share with you. They're somewhat general, that's in the nature of the beast, but I think they're still useful to contemplate. First of all, the group thought it would be helpful to start a high-level dialogue with political leaders in the region. Since the political leaders are absolutely critical, having them think about these sets of issues and perhaps talk to a few leaders, ex-leaders, former leaders, from maybe small countries that are comparable in their, at least in terms of their experience in the global economy, might indeed be helpful. It's an issue, an opportunity, which the Emerging Markets Forum institutionally is now pursuing to see whether something like this can be set up. Secondly, there was the conclusion that one should focus on the opportunities for cooperation where they are. The low-hanging fruit, if you like, for example, dealing with common threats such as natural disasters, with food security issues and others, rather than necessarily trying to tackle the big, difficult ones, such as, of course, water and energy nexus. Well, it's important to include the important players in the neighboring countries, Russia, China, but increasingly also South Asia, very likely, and have them engage in a dialogue with their Central Asian neighbors because, of course, Central Asia being a stable, prosperous, and effective transit point will be increasingly important. This building resilience into macroeconomic policies, actually, and I will probably hear from Pradeep, to some extent, the countries were really quite resilient in the face of the recent crisis, maybe even surprisingly so to some of us, but reinforcing that will be important in the future. Ensuring that international partners, not only the multilateral ones, but also the bilateral ones, stay engaged and keep a long-term time horizon is critical. We found in our research on regional cooperation that regional cooperation always is a long-term proposition. It never happens quickly in the short term. So you need to stay engaged both from within the region, but also through your support from the outside region. And then for all of us, I guess important to remember is that we need to consider cultural, historical, and political dimensions, especially as we think about how Central Asia and the Caucasus can move forward. Thank you very much for your patience, and I'll now hand off to Martha. Let me see, Martha, when I can get your thing up here. Oops, I can't find my... Where's the mouse? Here it is. There you go. How's that?
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, to be sharing the podium with my distinguished colleagues. It's great that the book is out. It's and I do feel privileged to have been able to do two chapters for it. I have not just come back from Tajikistan, though. I've come back from Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. But I am just finishing a book on Tajikistan, as Fiona mentioned. And in my presentation today, I try to bring together the two papers that I wrote. And then I'm going to end with some conclusions that aren't on the slides about how the year has changed things, because this book was written. None of us updated our papers. We just cleaned them. And I'm really thankful to the Emerging Markets Forum for enduring my tables, because I'll present here some material that isn't, I don't think all these charts are in the book because we had copyright issues, but so for the slideshow, there are no copyright issues, but I don't have the copyright on everything I'm showing you. Okay. The slideshow tries to bring together the two chapters in talking about, the first was on rivalry and competition in Central Asia, where I sought to explain the causes of the conflicts and the tensions that exist in the area. And I did, as the slide show talks about, I mean, it's competing notions of history and geography. Some of these have become more apparent in the past year. The other was the lingering impact of the Tajik Civil War, of which I have a slide, but that was always the model of what hell could look like in Central Asia if this occurred in other places. Since, and I'll come back to this at the end, there are new fears in terms of regional cooperation that are brought on by the unrest in Kyrgyzstan, regime change, but especially the unrest in the south, and by the Arab Spring. And so the fear of overflow across borders has become more profound than when we gave the papers a year ago, and I certainly would have put that in. Competing leadership styles and economic philosophies, which I'm not going to talk about much today, but which I talk about at some length in my paper. I mean, that you have a competition in the region between, let's crudely call it the Kazakh model of development and the Uzbek model of development, between opening to a global system and macroeconomic reform and deciding to put, have a conservative state-driven approach to economic development and assert the needs to protect one's population above all to external shocks, and I'll come back to that too. The lack of cooperation in the water-energy nexus, and I just bring this up slightly in the chapter. I'm happy to talk about it in questions if people want. I mean, this is obviously a topic that I have, because I'm writing a book on Tajikistan and its political economy, spent a ton of time on. And the consequences of these topics, which, and I think this is slightly less true today than a year ago, that the Central Asian states, because of all this conflict, it is possible for outside actors to play one state off against the other. And I would argue that the states of Central Asia try to play outside actors off one against the other in their desire to gain advantage over neighbors. But again, I think this is a factor that in this tense year has not become more profound. If anything, it's become more limited. Okay, let me talk briefly about the competing notions of history in these wonderful historic maps. I think it's really, when you talk about all the Central Asian states, and increasingly, as we hit the 20th anniversary of independence, I'm concerned when we lump all these countries together, because as somebody who, you know, is a frequent flyer on all these national airlines, these countries are very distinct one from the other, and each trip the distinctions become more profound. So they're evolving in very different ways, and when I'm classifying them together, it's because they still, you know, for some of them, they still reach the sea through each other, and they still are members of the same, many of them are members of the same organization, some of them, nobody's a member of all the same organizations as everybody else. Okay, so Because Kyrgyzstan is still the only one in the WTO. So, all right. But at the core in this process of national consolidation and state building are very different conceptions of history, very different conceptions of how you tell the history of Central Asia. And each of the countries tells the history of their own people and their own country in a way that is from their point of view and in some way encroaches on the territory of their neighbor. And I'm not saying that they have claims to each other's territories. Some do. But what I'm saying is that when they tell of the great past of their people, the boundaries of that great past are different than the boundaries of today in each case. And I'm just putting forward three different sort of maps of Central Asia that give you people's historic mindset. And this is the 10th century map. And the light blue is the Samanid state. And that's really the Tajik view of history. The Tajik view of history starts their history. I mean, everybody starts it before, but the core of their history is the Samanid Empire, and this is their view of what Tajikistan is. Tajikistan is that place that ruled at that point of time, and of course, the capital of the Samanid Empire was Bukhara. And Bukhara, the mausoleum of Samani himself, is on their currency, on some of their currency. So it's one of two cases that I know of where you put an object in another country on your national currency. The other is Mount Ararat in Armenia. And there may be other countries that do it too, but these two are very striking. The second is, this is a map of 14th century Central Asia, and this is the period of Timur. And this is really the conception of state building of Uzbekistan. They build their state around the legacy of Timur, other legacies too, but with Timur's statue downtown and the museum right there. You know, this is their notion of the relationship of state and society, their golden period in history. The territories overlap. It's a different view of history for sure. And it makes the claim that the Uzbek people, that these are their ancestors. It's not making an ethnic claim, but it is claiming ancestordom from this point in time. This is the historic map of the 16th to 20th century, but why I have it is, I mean, this is the Kazakh view of history, in a sense, you know, starts with the period of the formation of the period of what the Kazakhs now consider their period of Kazakh statehood, and I will be corrected if I'm using the wrong terms. But it's where this period, beginning in the 15th century and going through till the 18th century before colonial rule came, and it's that much looser territorial expanse that they talk about when they talk about that history. So that's their, you know, their reference point. The Kyrgyz and Turkmen have different reference points. Okay. The Civil War. Again, I make the point that the Civil War is, until the Kyrgyz crisis, was the rooting point of what people feared in the area. Now what people fear in the area is regime change and transition. And whether this is, and I'll come back briefly to this in the conclusion, but whether this longevity of office, in office, is now a real fact. This was a fact that people were concerned about in the region when they talked about stability, cross-border stability risks, that they were concerned about before events in the Arab world. And my assistant, Diana Galpern, found these pictures of all the presidents when they took power and what they look like today. And it makes the point with the region's three longest-serving leaders that they've gotten older, and two of them are over 70. So whether or not there will be a contagion factor from the Middle East, and I don't believe that there will, at some point the leaders will change, and that's what people are concerned about, instability at the time that leaders who don't leave office to be replaced in an electoral process at the end of whatever term they're in right now, could lead to unrest. You know, that if there is a sudden regime change by popular overthrow, which I don't think people see as a real threat in most of these countries, or by nature taking its toll, by people reaching the natural end of their lives. That is the concern. The water energy nexus, I still believe, is the major risk to to stability in Central Asia. Although, and I say this in the paper, although now I would really argue that the Kyrgyz-Uzbek border creates a huge ongoing risk in the region, too. But the competition, I mean, this is the water, this is the flow of the two rivers. The competition over water resources in the Amu Darya River, there is a regime that governs the Sir Darya River, an interstate regime that does a much better job governing the Sir Darya River. It's really, the fights are really over the headwaters of the Amu Darya, and the Tajik plans to develop the Rogun Dam, and if the dam is developed and if the hydroelectric station is developed outside of guidelines issued, before guidelines issued, after a World Bank report is done, and it hasn't even been started as when I last checked. It was just going to start. They were giving the contract the end of June, apparently. If the Tajiks go too far on their own, then that creates the risk in the region of stability, instability based on water. The second paper is on oil and gas, and I'm going to go much faster through this because I want to talk about some of the conclusions, and I only have about 5 minutes. The point that I try to make about... I try to make 2 points in the paper about oil and gas reserves, and they haven't changed dramatically over the last year. The first is to really talk about, I'm trying to think of a way to say this clearly. We shouldn't confuse the geopolitical questions about the development of the reserves and the significance of the reserves themselves. They're two separate questions. I mean, the fossil fuel resources are important to three Central Asian states. We tend to talk about the great geopolitics in terms of two states, Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan. But really, we have to look at three states. Uzbekistan makes a great deal of its national income from its gas sales. And Uzbekistan produces, I don't have the production table in here. Uzbekistan, this is oil reserves, this is gas reserves. And you see the relative positions in both. When we talk about oil, Kazakhstan is the only global player in the oil market. When we talk about gas, you have three critical players potentially. Turkmenistan, which is clearly a global player, and Kazakhstan, in which gas is more than just an economic trifle. And in Uzbekistan, where the reserves are much smaller than Turkmenistan, but where Uzbekistan still produces roughly the same amount of gas each year as Turkmenistan. One of the big differences is Uzbekistan uses a lot more of its gas than Turkmenistan. It has a population that's almost about 8 times the size, and it's an important source of domestic fuel. But at the same time, Uzbekistan has been a traditional and very important regional gas provider, and it's also an export provider for Russia. You know, Uzbek gas does go into the Russian system. So we have to look at it as an economic question for the countries involved, as well as for a geopolitical issue. And I think in terms of the geopolitical issue, it's important not to exaggerate the importance of these countries as providers. I mean, as I say, Kazakhstan is clearly a global oil provider. Turkmenistan is a global gas provider. But if I had to choose between whose shoes I'd want to be in, I'd rather be a global oil provider than a global gas provider, because oil doesn't get stranded, and gas can get stranded. Or you can get tied to a single purchaser. Okay. Proven reserves. I'm going to skip over so I can go to it. In terms of the pipelines, since the book has been written, there's been very little change or movement on the pipeline question. It looked like in the beginning of the year that the Turkestan, the TAPI pipeline across Afghanistan, was getting more life, but it seems to be dragged down a little again this last week or two. But that's the only one where I think that there's new movement. The big story, really, is the introduction of China, and that I talk about in this paper, and that hasn't changed over the past year at all. This is a picture of the presidents of all the countries involved, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and China, opening the first spigot to allow the flow of gas through the pipeline that goes across all their countries. It's a rare moment you get all these people together being photographed alone without outside actors, you know, without other countries. And I think this really speaks to the importance, the symbolic importance of this photo is really, it speaks to a new reality in the region, which is China's emergence as a critical player, and I would argue the long-term single most important player in Central Asia's economy. It doesn't mean they overshadow everybody else, but I think we're entering a period where they will be the dominant foreign actor. And this is like my penultimate point before I go to the conclusion. The big change that I talk about is, I think, everybody to draw everybody's attention to the South Yolatan project in Turkmenistan, which is now entering its first phase, which is the first major project in Central Asia, giant project, global project, with a mega deposit in which there is no Western multinational oil company involved, in which the technology for a difficult-to-work project is coming in from service providers. If this succeeds, and the first indications are that it will, then we've really reshaped what it takes to develop oil and gas in difficult areas. And this is a very new phenomenon and a real increase in China's potential. I'm going to get rid of the pipelines and go to the end. Let me just spend my last 2 minutes talking about what's changed and summarizing what I think has changed over the past year since the papers were written. As I've talked about, Kyrgyzstan has clearly become the focus of regional concern. Will this current Kyrgyz model hold? And I think this is really the question, not for other political actors in the region. I think we exaggerate the degree to which politicians in Central Asia are concerned that this is parliamentary and not presidential and this is democratic and we don't like democracy. I think really the focus is, will this create a stable government in Kyrgyzstan? And if this model works, that's the concern, to not have political turmoil in Kyrgyzstan. And the question is whether it will work, whether the Kyrgyz will in their own way transform the system into something else, into a stronger presidency, which I think may well happen. And will they continue to hold the lid on tension in southern Kyrgyzstan, whether the situation will be stable, because there is real concern that after if there's instability in southern Kyrgyzstan again, that it could be difficult for Uzbekistan to play the same role of accommodating refugees temporarily that they did the last time. So nobody wants Uzbekistan to be pulled into a conflict in Kyrgyzstan. This has displaced Tajikistan's internal problems as a focus, and the water tension between Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. But the situation in Tajikistan still concerns other political actors in the region. On the positive note, I think that the crisis in Kyrgyzstan has caused, at least in the short term, it has been a cause of more rapprochement at this moment in time between the Kyrgyz and the Uzbeks than have been before. The two governments are working together with less tension than was the case previously. And I think that the relationship between the Uzbek government and the Kazakh government has also improved to some degree, that there has been a lot more regional dialogue and dialogue across leaders on the issues in Kyrgyzstan. So in that sense, I don't think that there has been a short-term hit on regional cooperation, just that there is a new level of concern. Regional cooperation, the water energy nexus remains, as it is, a point of tension. Okay, a point about Johannes's point about improved transport. I think that there still are competing new transport routes. There's still difficulty between a Kazakh-driven vision of what these new transport routes, how they should be favored, and an Uzbek-driven vision of how they should be favored. And the two countries still have trouble working closely together on these questions. And I think that that the Kyrgyz crisis certainly has served once again to point up how all the states in the region will vote for national security over free trade regimes, because borders really did close at the time of the Kyrgyz crisis, and And border regimes have not returned to where they were, even though they've gone back partway. They've not returned to what they were before March 2010. And I think it's important, too, to note the customs union and Kazakhstan being in it and Kyrgyzstan not being in it has shifted some of the terms of trade. Okay. Energy. The Chinese project is moving forward. And I think, and this is my very last point, I think that in the past year, we have seen China become a stronger economic partner of each of the Central Asian states than they were previously. They're more involved in transit projects with Kazakhstan. They've become a more active partner with Tajikistan in metal, not just in metal resource extraction, metals extraction, but also in processing of metals. They've expanded their reach economically in Uzbekistan as well, and that's a big change. So I think overall, if we talk about, you know, who is going to help shape the directions that all these states emerge in individually and collectively, I think we see overall that it's harder and harder for people outside the region to really impact the region directly or indirectly, and bilaterally has proved the most effective thing. And when bilateral ties are reinforced by multilateral memberships, that's where you get the strongest combination of all. Thank you. Now I want to get this down. If you want to come up and we can see if we can get rid of me and get rid of Johannes. And I think I got you up. Okay. It's more high tech than I'm usually.
Okay, we've heard about what Central Asia looked like in the 10th century. What I'm going to be talking about is something which is much more contemporary. And one could argue that perhaps for that reason, the impact might be short-lived than a broader historical view of where the region stands. So this paper was written about a year and a half ago. It covered the impact of the global economic crisis, which was a very real event at that time in December of 2009. And it was motivated by saying, well, there's a lot of attention on what happens in Central Europe, in Eastern Europe, in Russia, in Ukraine. How has this crisis affected some countries that are not on the radar screen on a daily basis? And this covered Caucasus, Central Asia, and Mongolia. So that was the motivation. And the three questions that the paper deals with are, number one, how did that recession get transmitted to these countries? Secondly, how did they try to recover, and does that pose any systemic issues for the future? And third, were there some reforms which were suggested by the impact of the crisis which were possibly more important than others? So I'm not going to go through the whole slide because some of these things are less central to the story. This is more a setting the stage about real GDP growth, current account balances, and so on. The one point to make here is that most of the imbalances that one saw were driven by private sector-driven borrowing, as indeed it was in places further west, and less as a consequence of government imbalances. That's number one. Number two, there's a real split between Kazakhstan on the one hand and the other countries, because Kazakhstan is much more integrated into global financial markets. And so, in fact, Kazakhstan experienced its financial crisis a year before everybody else did, in the fall of 2007, when, because of concerns about creditworthiness, there was a sudden stop in capital flows from the outside world. And Kazakhstan, therefore, had to deal with two crises, one in 2007, and then its reinforcement when the global financial crisis struck in 2008. So to the channels of transmission. Now, we know that Russia is extremely important in the region. When Russia sneezes, some of the countries catch a cold, others contract pneumonia. It depends on the intensity. But the first thing was that the slowdown in Russia and also to some extent in Ukraine led to the export demand being constrained. So that was the first shock they had to deal with. Secondly, there was a huge fall in remittances. The construction sites in Russia simply started to close down. And people who had been working from these countries, and as you know, Tajikistan and is one of the most remittance-intensive countries in the world, but Kyrgyz Republic and Armenia were also important. They had people coming back. And there was a real fear at the time, a year and a half ago, as to whether this would create social tensions and how the countries concerned would be able to manage those tensions. The third is, since they're all, a lot of them are commodity-producing countries, in terms of the commodity prices took a dive during the global economic recession, and so this affected the oil exporters, the copper exporters, and the aluminum exporters, names being written up there. Now, I already mentioned the last bullet that the way in which this crisis was the same for this region as for the U.S. and Western and Central Europe was in Kazakhstan, which faced this capital account crisis as a result of a sudden stop in capital flows. In that way, Kazakhstan was different. So let's those are the channels of transmission. Let's look at the policy response. I'm not going to read everything that's on this chart. It's in the paper anyway. But basically, there were three kinds of responses. First was fiscal. Second was what to do about the financial sector because the banks were affected. And the third, which is on the next slide, which I'll come to, is the social safety net. What do you do when you have not only a huge downturn in economic activity, but also returning workers, remittance workers from Russia and Kazakhstan? Now, on the fiscal, there's just one point to be made, which is virtually all the countries decided that they were not going to tighten their fiscal policy very much because that would aggravate the recession. So the wisdom of countercyclical policymaking was very much in evidence. But the problem was, where would they get the financing to do that? What happened was that the commodity exporters, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, had stabilization funds, which they used to support a fiscal policy during the recession to give their countries a little bit of stimulus. And the energy importing countries, Armenia, Georgia, the Kyrgyz Republic, and Tajikistan, had IMF programs which did what the stabilization funds in the oil exporters were designed to do. But the extent of fiscal accommodation varied because some of the countries had come into the crisis with large amounts of debt and others not. And so there was a trade-off between how much stimulus you could give and how much debt accumulation there would be, a tension that is not entirely unknown in this country. Now, the second set of issues is financial sector. And here, banks got into trouble mainly because on their asset side, they had made loans which went bad, and so there had to be a resolution of the balance sheets. But the first part was also important, what we call containment, which is suddenly you find on the liability side of the bank balance sheets that external wholesale funding dries up. That's what happened in Kazakhstan in 2007. In Georgia, after their conflict with Russia in the summer of 2008, creditors were refusing to roll over maturing external debt. So there was a problem that one had to contain the crisis on the liability side of the bank balance sheet, and these were the countries, Kazakhstan and Georgia, for example, where it was important. But in Ukraine, for example, there was a little bit of a bank run because depositors were not confident that banks would make it through. That, fortunately, was less important in the Caucasus and Central Asia. So one had the containment on the liability side and the resolution on the asset side, and the resolution has turned out to be much more important, and indeed the banking sectors have not fully recovered, even now, from the shocks they had at that time. Now, the third part of the policy response was social safety nets. It gave me too long to go through this diagram, so let me give you the gist of what it is. It measures on the horizontal axis the coverage of social safety nets. That is to say, what proportion of the poorest quintile of households do they reach? So being further to the right is a good thing. Look at the vertical axis, which is targeting accuracy, which is what proportion of the money that a social safety net puts out actually goes to the poorest quintile of households. So there, too, being higher up is better. So northeast is better than southwest is the message here. We classified the countries. Now, the size of the bubble is actually how much the social safety net transfers. So being a large bubble to the northeast is better than being a very small bubble on the southwest. And if you look at, for example, the story in Georgia in the middle, they do have a pretty good targeted social assistance system, both in terms of coverage and targeting, but also generosity. And in general, if you look at Armenia and Georgia on that slide, and you compare it with the Central Asian countries, the safety nets were better developed in the Caucasus than in Central Asia and Mongolia. And so what the international institutions were saying at the time is, scale these things up where you have them, and where you don't have them, this is a good time to start. So those were the three elements of the policy response, the fiscal, the financial, and the social safety net. There is a discussion of structural reforms here. There's some very interesting findings in a book that we did at the time about how the whole socialist world, by which I mean the countries of the former Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact countries of Central and Eastern Europe, suddenly found by 2008 that infrastructure, physical infrastructure, and education, social infrastructure, which of course the socialist countries were extraordinarily good at, that they had lost their edge in those two areas compared to non-transition countries at the same level of per capita income as they were. So this came as a real surprise to those of us who were working on this at the time, and I think it also came as a surprise to the countries. So let me not go through the conclusions here very much because I've given you the main points. The issue is now, 18 months on, is there something which is different? And I don't follow these countries as closely as I used to when I worked in the World Bank. But when I see what, for example, the IMF has been saying in its latest World Economic Outlook, which came out in April, they're saying, well, the terms of trade have moved around, commodity boom in progress, so that's benefited some of the countries in this region. The workers are beginning to go back to the construction sites in Russia and Kazakhstan, so that's also working in their favor. The thing that hasn't changed is that the financial sectors, which took a hit in 2008-2009, still have not recovered, and there's a big agenda there. And the social safety nets, which, as I said, presented a mixed picture, depending on whether one was looking at Caucasus or Central Asia, haven't changed very much. Their bottom line is that they expect about 6% growth in Caucasus and Central Asia, which is pretty respectable. But as you know, the world the recovery from the recession is something on which questions have been recently raised about how durable it is, whether it's likely to be a double dip, and what might happen in Russia, which is a big driver for these countries. And so we'll have to wait and see how these countries eventually come out. But let me thank you for your attention and for giving the benefit of your focus to countries which are not normally talked about very much in the financial press. Thank you very much.
Great. I want to make sure that these mics working. Everyone can hear us at the back. Yep. Excellent. We have about 25 minutes left in the program. So what I'd like to do is take maybe three questions or comments from the floor. As I'd already noted, there are a number of people in here who are also experts on the region. And we'd like to hear from you too. Stranger. Oh, it's okay, good. It's just the screen going up. You can see we're all there. We have a microphone here coming down the aisle. And if I could ask, when you ask a question or make a comment, if you could also introduce yourselves for the benefit of the audience. And this gentleman here, please, with the glasses. Thanks.
My name is Brian Beery. I'm a Washington correspondent for Europolitics. And my question is a bit more on the geopolitics of the region. You know, you have three main regional neighbors, the China, Russia, and the EU. And I guess at this point, they're all competing for, you know, the attention or the greater trade links, especially on the energy front. I'm just wondering, from the perspective of the Central Asian governments, do they have any natural historical inclination to push them in one direction or the other? Or are they just approaching it from a very realpolitik point of view, and whoever sort of courts them the most and offers them the most, just how are they dealing with that issue?
Great, thank you. I thought I saw someone at the back. Maybe, yeah, no, and the gentleman right behind you here, and this gentleman here at the front. Thank you.
Yes, hello. My name is Jay Mitch. I'm with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and you had referred to the Russia-led customs union that involves some of the Central Asian countries. I'm curious how the speakers, the distinguished speakers, see the development of that. How successfully will it be economically and also politically? How successful will that be, Russia's ability to continue to project some kind of dominance in the region vis-a-vis China or other countries which are seeking to, you know, enter it? So I'm curious any views you have looking forward on the customs union.
Great, thank you. And then the gentleman here at the front, thanks.
Hi, I'm Altınbek Muralı from Kyrgyz Republic, actually an expert, not from here, I'm from insider. I would like to know your views and elaboration on the two main topics which are growing on. First is the Northern Distribution Network, which is really coordinated by the United States Central Command and Transportation Command in carrying goods to Afghanistan via Central Asian states and Russia. And second, especially a special question to Marfa about 20 years of experience, do we have succeeded in building the or ended the state formation process and how it will survive? Thank you.
Is that a specific question for Kyrgyzstan or for Central Asia overall, for the state, for Central Asia overall? Yeah. Well, that's a big question. Perhaps, Martha, I'll take an extra round of questions if you'd like to start there. So, 20 years, as you mentioned, we have the anniversary coming up of independence.
And I'm going to do a whole year of programming in the region on this question. So come back to me in another year. I mean, I think that it's really, it's too big a question to try to answer here and now. I think that there have been, as I said in my talk, the fact that you have five countries that have survived 20 years is already more than many people thought was going to happen. You have real differences between the countries. I mean, Kazakhstan has made itself a major minor international actor in the sense that they have a global role that they're beginning to carve out for itself. But that's what I mean by major minor, that they are seen as a responsible, active, global player. They're the only country in the region that has gotten to that point. The Uzbeks had some dreams of it, I think, but they haven't gotten to that point. So I think in each case, you have to look very seriously at how much they've achieved, which is consolidating nations, even the two most fragile of them, which is Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And in all five cases, you know, to have really created some sense of nation, which in my belief, in all five cases, will continue to survive the political transition that they face. More detailed than that, I really have to, like, tell you to wait till next year when we begin attacking this systematically. Let me take quickly some of the other points that came up. The Northern Distribution Network, I don't want to really spend a lot of time on. I think the question of the Northern Distribution Network is really outside the purview of this book, which was attempting to be a global look at more general problems in the region. I think that this has been a basis of enhanced U.S. cooperation with all the countries that are involved in some form with this. And the question that most people ask is, what is going to be the future of this cooperation as withdrawal from Afghanistan begins to occur? I don't know what President Obama said this morning, but I mean, this was going to be the big topic. And I do think my last comment on this is that there was a lost opportunity in these last 10 years of engagement in Afghanistan to build more regional cooperation and more capacity for producing things in the region than it was achieved. I think a huge lost opportunity. That's what my second chance was about, and concluded that we lost that opportunity. The customs union, I don't like to talk about Russian dominance. I mean, you're going to talk about it in other ways. I do think that Russia plays different roles in each of these economies. My own work talks a great deal about the role of remittances and the interdependence. Kazakhstan was very interdependent, as has been pointed out, in terms of its banking crisis. But I think that one of the things, if we talk about 20 years, is the capacity for any one actor who dominated previously to keep dominating has really been reshaped. All the five countries are very active definers of their own preferences. They define their own preferences with a sense of what their capacity is vis-a-vis other people's capacity, like Russia. But I don't think we're in a position of Russian domination. Russia's terms of trade in the energy industry have changed dramatically in the course of the last 10 years. I think Russia, even Russia to some degree, recognizes its declining capacity to be a single, to be an active agent, save where it's the Russian Federation that is the host. Whether people court them historically, I mean, obviously, there is 150 years of interaction between the Central Asian economies and the Russian economy. This generation of leaders is still Russian-speaking. But I think that the relationships are determined by practical concerns more than anything else. With China the same, I mean, the histories of the Kazakh and Kyrgyz people both have periods where they feared the Chinese, you know, and it's certainly a national issue. Kyrgyz nationalists have done the most with this as a platform than anybody else in the region. But everybody's very pragmatic about what China offers. And that takes me through all the questions.
Martha, let me just actually press you on one issue, and actually your comments have raised for me from the other questions that were posed from the audience a couple of other points. One is really Turkmenistan. We actually didn't really speak about Turkmenistan too much in the overviews, and it always seems to be the odd man out, so to speak, in Central Asia. Partly that's by preference, a choice at least of the leadership of opting out of so many of the multilateral arrangements and professing neutrality. But it's also because it's perhaps the most impenetrable of the states, the most isolated in many respects in terms of transportation and communication, although less so now. Lots of international conferences do take part in Ashgabat, and there's a lot of trans-Caspian trade. But when you talked about the two most fragile states of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, we've talked about leadership transitions. Obviously, Mr. Niyazov left the scene as a result of natural causes. There was a rather opaque transition. And it does still leave the question about what we might expect down the road for Turkmenistan. The other issue was really about the NDN, as our colleague suggested, and perhaps actually Johannes and Pradeep may comment on this as well, as to whether the development of the NDN over the last year, 2 years, some of our colleagues at CSIS have done quite a bit of work on that, which I know you cited in the book, whether it's spurred anything different and additional to the transportation, communication and transit networks that were being developed anyway under CAREC and TRASECA and some of the other multilateral formats, and whether there's something that has been developed as a result of NDN that might stay on after withdrawal. Clearly, it's been a spur to rail transit and has been very beneficial to the Russian railway networks in particular, that had seen a drop-off in their freight as a result of the recession. And none of this has been free. The US has been paying for a lot of this transit. So, I mean, could we expect another long-term impact to rail transit and other freight forwarding as a result of the withdrawal that may be detrimental to some of the transportation developments? And then you mentioned, you know, the legacy of elites who were Russian-speaking. What is going to be the lingua franca in the region moving forward? I mean, clearly there's been a big boost in English language study. At one point, Turkic or Turkish language through networks of Turkish language schools was developing. But there is a lot of question about, do people invest time and effort in Chinese language study? Or is English language, you know, sufficient as Russian erodes as perhaps the lingua franca in the region? And I think that's another point in the communications, literal communications, that Johannes was touching on in the overview, that would be, you know, curious to see where we see things heading. So if you want to sure. pick up on some of these, and then Johannes and okay. Pradeep, if I can ask you to think about those questions as well.
I'll do the Turkmen and the legacy of the elites, I think, together. Turkmenistan is the most impenetrable for us as Westerners to study. It's a very close society to us. I think in that regard, I didn't speak about its fragility. When I lecture on the Arab Spring and its impact in Central Asia, I always say that, you know, the one place where I think we can't predict what's going to happen is Turkmenistan. It's not clear to me that Berdimuhamedov has fully consolidated his power. I don't believe that you'd have an Arab Spring there. I think in a society you don't understand well, there's always a chance that there will be an elite-led effort to replace somebody. That doesn't mean, I just can't, I'm not predicting it, but I can't put odds on it either way. You know, that's always something we have to be prepared for in a country we don't understand well. But I do disagree with your notion that Turkmenistan is isolated. I mean, I don't think it is isolated. It's not open to us, you know.
Right. Okay.
And I think that Turkmen movement to Turkey, Turkmen movement with Iran has increased dramatically. And that really takes me to this notion of, I don't really see this as a region as we move forward. If we go 10 years down the road, I think that Central Asian states will hang together even less well than they do, that people, each country will have different patterns of international integration. And the lingua franca is going to show that up. There isn't going to be a lingua franca in the area. The Central Asian leaders will no longer be able to meet in private as a group if they choose to without translators if we go 20 years down. They won't be the same languages for each of them. I don't know that the Central Asian, the Turkmen leader in 20 years will have Russian. I doubt he'll be fluent in Chinese. He may be fluent in English. But to count on all these five people having the same language that they can talk to each other is going to be very remote. There's much more attention to Chinese language education than there was previously. But it still remains a small group of people by comparison to those who know English. And, of course, in many of the countries, Russian is going to remain a key second language for much of the population. But no, it's going to be a different world. And the Northern Alliance, and I'd be curious to get everybody else's reactions, it's created some investment in things that weren't getting as much investment. Like you talk about the rail links, the much greater ease of transport across the Tajik-Afghan border, and that's going to stay. And that may actually be a destabilizing force in the future if Afghanistan doesn't hang together as a country. It will put Tajikistan hanging together, a country, at much greater risk. But the biggest bottlenecks, the ones many of them that Johannes talked about, haven't been addressed, you know, by this. The Tajiks still don't have shipping alternatives by rail that bypass Uzbekistan, and there hasn't, as I said, this the the Northern Distribution Alliance, at least network, in my view, hasn't created a new basis of regional trust, in addition to not creating this regional, the kind of economic interdependence healthy for all of them by producing things in the region, hasn't been produced. It hasn't created new reservoirs of trust either among the Central Asians, or I would argue, there's not long, there's concern about U.S. longevity, so it's not created long-term trust of the U.S. either.
No, those are very important points. I especially think the point that the region is not isolated, it just may be isolated from us, is perhaps one of the most key takeaways here. And I think that's a point that you have been making, Johannes, in your overview in any case, and these shifting regional patterns. So.
Right. Well, maybe just picking up on the NDN, Northern Distribution Network, what I've seen written on it is mostly through the lens of what does it mean for Afghanistan, in particular the shifting balance between supplies through Pakistan, which had been dropping quite rapidly relative to the much now very significant amount of support that comes non-lethal, I guess, mostly through, or all of it, through the Northern Distribution Network. There has been very little analysis, in fact, none that I've seen, that looks at the impact on both positive and negative. Positive in demonstrating that this can be done, that it's, you know, at one level cost-effective. It's probably a bit more costly than the other way, but it can be done. So that's good news. Setting up longer-term links and institutional frameworks for facilitating that trade, probably helpful. On the other hand, as Martha in the past has pointed out to me, I think rightly, maybe the deterioration of road and networks in particular that results from it and the costs may not be fully recovered. Nobody, I frankly, knows, has looked at this. So this is actually, I think, is an important research topic that maybe the World Bank at some point, our colleagues there, former colleagues, should pick up on and sort of, you know, cost-benefit analysis of what, plus what is the lasting impact and, frankly, even more so, what could be done to maximize the beneficial long-term impact, use this window, and it's probably just a window for a while, of opportunity, both in terms of demonstration effect, but also in terms of lasting improvements in institutions and so on. So I think it's a very interesting question. I'm glad somebody raised it, but I don't have the answer, and I don't think at this point anybody has the answer. If somebody does, please let me know. On Turkmenistan, I haven't dealt much with Turkmenistan, but I do see now a number of signs of Turkmenistan actually integrating more, at least in terms of international institutions. Uh-huh. It's now much more open to, as far as I know, to, for example, collaboration with Asian Development Bank, also with UNDP. I don't know about the World Bank. Maybe you know something about that, Pradeep. I haven't followed it. It is also joined, and this is a huge step for Turkmenistan, it's joined the CARIC. Now, CARIC is not a formal agreement-based organization. It's more of an informal forum. But still, for years, Turkmenistan's been sitting on the sideline. Now it has joined, and I think that's a terrific sign, and now can be integrated also as a result in, if you remember that corridor map I showed, explicitly incorporated, which it hasn't been so far in terms of planning, monitoring, and so on, which is very good news. So I'm actually on that ground, but it's a limited picture I have. I'm somewhat more optimistic than I have been in the past. On the lingua franca, again, to some extent, basing my experience on sort of 15 years of working in Central Asia, I've seen in the formal settings and in interacting with people at relatively high private sector and public sector levels in the region, I've seen a significant improvement in the ability to speak English. And even in the ability now also with a broader context, of course, you now have, you know, Tajiks are meeting with Afghans. Now they could speak, I guess, and do speak
and they do.
Farsi. But even Uzbeks, they will speak, most likely will speak English. And many of them will be able to do so, at least at the higher levels. On the other hand, it's still true today in the CARIC context, for example, the Russian speakers will speak most to each other and huddle in corners, which can be helpful or not, depending on their relationship, while the English-speaking, whether it's Mongolians, Chinese, or Afghanis, now Pakistanis, will tend to sort of speak English with each other. But my prediction would be, frankly, over 20 years, English will be the lingua franca at the higher level of exchanges. Now, that is not necessarily in the popular domain, where Russian still will be very important, of course, and Chinese may increase, also Turkish may be a factor. But I think my projection would be that in terms of a higher level of engagement, it will be English, will be the lingua franca for better, or maybe, who knows, maybe worse, I don't know. And let me close my response quickly on the first question, the geopolitics. I would maybe start from a slightly different perspective, not so much what are the leanings and the orientations, natural or otherwise, of the Central Asian and Caucasus countries, but more thinking about it from the perspective of the big sort of neighbors and powers that in the geopolitical context. And what I've been impressed with, especially for Central Asia, maybe less so the case in the Caucasus, as I've been watching this over the years, is how, if you step back and think about it, how fundamentally aligned many of the interests are between Russia, China, EU, and the US. The US being the most distant, in some sense, frankly, on the ground, the least important in many ways, in many areas. But the interests are aligned in the following sense, that a stable, prosperous, and integrated Central Asia is a common interest for all of them. And a Central Asia that is split, that is at war with each other, that is poor and deteriorating, that maybe is the potential hotbed for terrorism or whatever, is in nobody's interest. So from my perspective, that is the overarching alignment of interests. Now there's competition to some extent for energy resources. There's of course in the global geopolitical scene, there's still some sense of, well, will somebody hew my line at the UN or whatever or not, and so on. But in general, I see, if anything, the great game is, in a sense, is over. That would be my bottom line on this. Now, from the country's perspective, I think it depends to some extent. You have countries like Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, which culturally, linguistically, and so on, are still very, very much oriented towards Russia, at least as far as I see this. You have an Uzbekistan that is maybe much less so, and in some sense more isolationist. Turkmenistan is difficult to tell. In the Caucasus, of course, there's considerable differences of orientation. Fundamentally, my sense is realpolitik is most of it now when it comes to the political decisions and opportunities for playing one off against another in terms of big neighbors will be chosen where it brings gains. What I miss, frankly, and this is where coming back to one of the conclusions of the Emerging Markets Forum, is that I don't feel we yet see among the countries of what maybe is an artificial region, but they're there for better or worse, all of them, is among the leadership enough recognition that there are huge opportunities for more cooperation and that that economic perspective would drive their political decisions. That I don't see happening yet. And to me, that was the biggest less takeaway from Martha's paper on that maybe, I don't know whether we would put it that way, but that the economic benefits don't yet have sort of play the role that they should. Now, if you go back to the Yugoslav experience and post-Yugoslav experience, of course, the lesson to me there was that economics wasn't, the economic benefits of integration, cooperation, wasn't worth a damn when people decided they wanted to make war with each other because of whatever political and ethnic and reasons. The economic damage and the economic losses were worthless. So the big fear I have for Central Asia is sort of a Yugoslav Southeast Asia scenario of the 1990s, and I hope and pray that it won't happen. I don't see it at the moment. I don't see that risk materializing because I think ultimately the sense of preservation and the sense of long-term stability among the leadership is also strong. But the concrete wish to create economic benefits from greater cooperation, that doesn't seem to be there.
Pradeep, perhaps you could pick up on that last point about the concrete economic benefits. I mean, how do things seem to you, and having listened and also to the questions?
When you look at the data on trade flows, on remittances, to some extent on foreign direct investment, For Caucasus and Central Asia, overwhelmingly, it's still with Russia. Mm-hmm. That is not, to me, anything which suggests an unreasonable degree of dominance or anything like that. That's the natural... I mean, if you look at the degree of integration with Russia compared to degree of integration of various neighboring countries with other big countries in other parts of the world, this is in no sense abnormal or excessive. So it seems to me that one should not draw necessarily political lessons about Russian dominance or hegemony or whatever it is from that data. But it also shows at the margin, certainly for Kyrgyz Republic and for Kazakhstan, a hugely growing trade link with China. Mm-hmm. And that will become important, but at the moment it's happening at the margin. So point number one, yes, there will be integration with big countries. I haven't mentioned Turkey, which is important for some of the Central Asian countries in terms of FDI and so on. This will continue. That's the normal state of affairs, and it will probably increase. But I just want to make a slightly broader point here, which is, what do we learn from the experience of these countries in responding to a global crisis about the benefits of isolation versus integration? A lot of these countries were pretty isolated in terms of world financial markets and international trade flows. And they weren't that hard hit by international events. They were hit by trade links with Russia and the immediate neighborhood, if you like. But Kazakhstan is the interesting exception, because it was integrated into world financial markets. And as a result of that, in part, it suffered a huge shock, both in 2007 and 2008, which came to the financial sector, because it had a more developed financial sector and it was integrated. It's interesting how the Kazakhstani authorities have dealt with that and imposed solutions on banks and so on, which do offer some lessons on how to do this kind of thing. But on balance, I would say that more integration, although it brings risks, at the end the benefits outweigh the risks if the process is reasonably managed. And so I think we can look forward with certain degree of optimism about the increasing integration of Caucasus and Central Asia, but bearing in mind that there will be setbacks, but not to interpret those setbacks as the harbinger of some long-term unfavorable trend.
Well, Pradeep, that actually seems like a good place to stop. Well, we should always stop while we're ahead. And we're already at the time, and I think that was actually a very good wrap-up in terms of not being put off by the setbacks. I think we also came up with a number of other areas that could certainly give Martha another book project, but actually I know I can see some people in the audience who might be looking for one, and the longer-term impact of the Northern Distribution Network, as Johannes has pointed out and everyone else has, obviously needs a lot more scrutiny. And against the backdrop of the announcements, or at least the discussions today about withdrawal from Afghanistan and what impact that might have on Central Asia from these transportation linkages that were just starting to be consolidated, obviously gives us a lot of questions in looking ahead. But I'd like to thank all of the audience for coming. I do hope that many of you managed to get hold of the book. And really great vote of thanks to Martha, Johannes, and Pradeep, and all the other authors for doing such a great job. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you.